Our guest is Carol Carroll, a man who has been so much involved in the radio days that we hardly know where to begin. Where did your radio career begin, Carol Carroll?
Well, it actually began about 1930 when I did an impossible thing for the American Radiator Company. It was called Birthday Breakfast, or some such fancy name as that. And the idea was, for instance, if it was coming up Washington's birthday, they'd have a breakfast for Washington, and Washington would be there, and all his friends would sit around the table and slurp coffee and say what a wonderful man he was. Actually, you know what it was? It was an early Roastmaster. Shows you. Uh-huh. That's exactly what it was. People would say, so you chopped down a cherry tree, huh? What did your father really do to you? Well, this was the kind of a thing. I did a few of those, and the money was great. It was $15 for half an hour. And I got into that because my agent said there may be something there, and I did a few of them. But I could make more money doing what I was doing, which was writing for Life, which was then a humor magazine. Mm-hmm. And I was on the staff of Judge. And I wrote for The New Yorker before it began to take itself seriously. And all the places where you could sell what were called casual comic pieces or light verse, this was the only way people had of getting jokes. Or they went to vaudeville, which I did a lot. I was a vaudeville buff. And then there came something you might have heard about in 1929 called the Depression. I was on the New York Sunday World at the time. They had a section, such as every paper has it. They called theirs the Metropolitan section. Mm-hmm. And I began reviewing radio. I did a column reviewing radio shows and writing other pieces for the thing. And then little by little, vaudeville and hard times... radio and hard times, started to put the humor magazines out of business because advertisers don't want to spend money on a publication that isn't giving them much circulation, and these rags weren't, because the last thing a person bought when he was hungry was a funny magazine.
Yeah, right.
And they shrunk and shrunk until they shrunk themselves right out of business. And little by little, my market disappeared. Fortunately, radio didn't disappear. It was coming up. And I'd had all this advertising experience and joke writing experience. And I stumbled on some people from J. Walter Thompson who decided that maybe I could help them out. They had Eddie Cantor at the time and Rudy Valley. And Burns and Allen happened to be what I got when I got there. But I think I have in my book the ridiculous way that I got the job. They called me and they said that they needed 5 2.5-minute bits for Eddie Cantor for the Christmas Eve show, and Eddie wanted to be a little newsboy standing at the subway station trying to sell his papers in the snow on Christmas Eve. Very funny idea, you know. Little match girl starving to death, and her mother is home with asthma, and her father's got a bad leg. Everybody, you know. Anyway, they asked if I could do it, and they said they'd give me $50 a piece for them. Well, $50 in 1932 was pretty good money for a 2.5-minute thing, as they were doing then. And I said, well, when do you want these? They said, oh, tomorrow morning. This was about 3 p.m. So I sat up all night, and I wrote these things, and I thought they were sensational, and I got all my family around. I said, when do you hear Eddie Cantor do these wonderful jokes I did about this poor, starving little newsboy? And we gathered around the radio Sunday evening, and not one syllable of what I wrote was on the air, not even a comma. So I said, well, that's that job. A few days, about a week or so later, I was working at that time for a film organization called Tobis Klang Film Syndicat AG. As you can guess, it was not an American company. That was the German competitor to UFA in those days. And they had decided that they'd open a theater in New York. They opened the Vanderbilt Theater. I think it's on 48th Street. And we're bringing in a little doozy called The Brothers Karamazov, which more people didn't want to see than any picture around. And they had more people in it that nobody had ever heard of than you could believe, but they had a beautiful woman named Anna Sten. So I ran my little legs off with pictures of Anna Sten and the stuff, and the result of that was she got a contract with Sam Goldwyn. Anyway, I was working for this German film company as a press agent. And they called me thinking a guy works for a German film company. Well, he certainly understands German. Well, I was having trouble with English. So what they had in mind was to do some radio audition of European operas and operettas that had never been produced in America. And they had a little deal called Paganini, which, logically enough, was about an Italian violinist, but the libretto was in German. So they said, can you do this? I said, oh, sure, I can do anything. And I took this German libretto. It was about that thick. They wanted a half an hour. It was must have been a 3.5 hour show. And the first thing I did, there was a girl at the Tobis Company who translated the dialogue of films to give to the immigration people so they could be sure you weren't bringing any dirty stuff in. And, of course, the translations never bore any relation to what the film was really about. Anyway, I told her to just give me a literal translation of it, never mind putting it into any kind of English. Just I want to know what it was about, what each scene was about, and to translate the lyrics, so that I'd know what they were singing about. Then I got a friend to play the score for me, and I picked out 3 or 4 tunes and wrote some lyrics for them and pinned it together with some dialogue that I made up, and it was a half an hour. Oh, and they were delighted with it. Tickled to death. They never even produced it. So there was another big triumph that I had.
Well, you were getting paid for these.
Oh, yes, I got paid my $250 for the candid thing, and I got $250 for this little deal. $250 was a number they had in their head. I don't know where they got it. I liked it. I made it my phone number. So the next thing I think, well, these people are out of their minds. The next thing that happened was they called me again, and they had a strip show called The Stebbins Boys, which was a kind of a third cousin to Lum and Abner, if you remember them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Little town where these two guys ran something and jabbered with each other in a New England dialect for 8 minutes, and the other 5 minutes was commercial. So there seems the fellow who wrote this thing had slipped into the bottle, and they didn't have a strip for the following week. And they called me, and I think naturally the guy who writes stuff that doesn't get produced. And they told me what they needed, and they said, had I heard the show? And I said, of course I'd heard the show. I'd never even heard of the show. So I listened to the show, and I got what I thought was a smashing idea for this little town. At that time, there was a lot of talk about something that was then called a silent policeman. This was a kind of a buoy-shaped thing in the middle of a cross-section that controlled traffic. It was a traffic light in the middle of the street for little communities that couldn't afford a live policeman. So I brought a guy in town to sell this to Stebbins Boys, a silent policeman for their town. They said, it'll solve your traffic problem. They said, we haven't got a traffic problem. And the salesman said, will you put this in? And you will have. So this was the whole basis for five things. And that was a great idea. But the guy sobered up and did his thing. And that never got on the air. And that, I figured, had washed up my career with the J. Walter Thompson Company. But 3 weeks later, I got a call could I come down and see him. They had just hired Burns and Allen and wanted to know if I would like to take a permanent job with them, and of course I would. Anybody offering permanent jobs at that time was not to be sneered at. And that was in March of 1932, and I was with them until 67. January 67.
So you wrote for Burns and Allen through their whole radio?
Not through their whole. I wrote for them for about 2.5 years, and then I moved on to other things. But I traveled with Annette and Googie, as everybody called him now, because that was his name, Nathaniel Birnbaum.
Uh-huh. And Googie was
Gracie.
Gracie, yeah.
She's the darlingest woman I ever knew. I get tears in my eyes thinking of it.
They were on for Robert Burns Cigars.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were on for, with Guy Lombardo.
Uh-huh.
The guy who ran the radio department at J. Walter Thompson was a great big Pennsylvania Dutchman with thumbs that bent all the way back, indicating how stubborn he was. Who had the wonderful idea of putting things together that were a little bit antagonistic, and thus making enough people mad on each side so that they would listen out of sheer anger. And so he put Guy Lombardo, the sweetest music this side of heaven, was what he was billing himself as, and this comedy couple together. And the music went on all the time, and we'd fade it down, and Gracie and Nat were supposed to be dancing, which was what they did in their act. They danced, and he would say, stop, and they'd tell a joke, and then they'd start to dance again. Well, they left out the stop, and they just did these little routines, and then the music would come up, and they go. And we got letters, how can you interrupt that beautiful music for those terrible jokes? And who needs that music when that lovely little lady is on there saying those wonderful things? And it worked like a charm. It worked like a charm every time Reber tried it, until he put together Milton Berle and Charles Laughton. Then it didn't work at all.
Well, that's quite a combination there.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. I did a show. It was Milton Berle, Charles Laughton, and Bob Crosby's Bobcats. There's a parlay.
Mm.
And this was just about as successful as Hitler's effort in World War II.
That Burns and Allen with Guy Lombardo, didn't they sometimes broadcast from two different parts of the country?
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. I used to travel with Burns and Allen sometimes. There was a unit of Burns and Allen and Guy Lombardo that went together, and then occasionally they'd split up, and Guy and the band would go one place, and Nat and Googie would go another place, and I went with them, of course, because I didn't have to write anything for the band. This was funny in those days, because this was a miracle to most people, that a band could be playing in St. Louis or Chicago, and these people could be talking in Indianapolis, and they were together. It was a miracle to us, too, sometimes.
But they did it, huh?
One place in Indianapolis, the only place, the station there was hardly more than a switching station. They had a room about the size of an average living room, which they called a studio, and they used for broadcasting any spot news in case anything happened in Indianapolis. But they didn't have to use it often, because nothing ever did. But that's where we were supposed to broadcast. And in this case, we were all together. The band, 11 pieces, I think Guy had, and Nat and Gracie. And we wound up with the band scattered around in all different places in the office. And all over, I remember the elevator had to be turned off so that it wouldn't come up while George and Gracie were doing their routines, because it was an elevator that they'd apparently stolen from some old Parisian hotel and imported at great cost. Made a lot of noise. And about 15 minutes before airtime, I said to the guy running the station, I said, is that clock right? You know, it's a routine question if you're going to put on a broadcast that has to fit into the network. Mm. And he said, I don't know, what time have you got? Well, I looked at my watch, and my watch was about 7 minutes different from this wall clock that he had. So I literally had to call New York to find out what time it was so that we could hit the air.
And you had to hold the elevator.
Hold the elevator for half an hour.
You were mostly writing gags then, right? Or situations for Burns and Allen?
At the time I'm speaking, we just did gag routines that were mostly about her brother and his terrible problem. And later we did Life with Gracie, which was a sort of a situation. She had wonderful ideas. She for instance, she thought it would be a better idea instead of having the elevator go up and down in the building to hold the elevator still and have the building go up and down, which is just as good. And stuff like that. But I worked with Nat and Nat's brother Willie and a guy named Harvey Helm. And at that time, John Medbury in out here was sending Burns two-liners and one-liners. And we used to put this stuff together from what I could think of and what all of us. And we sat down and talked the thing to a secretary who now lives here and is married to Nat Perrin, the producer. Excuse me. I used to call her Halfies because she used to say, who'll go Halfies on a malted with me? No, she never could drink a whole malted. So that's how I got started in the business. When I traveled around with Burns and Allen, I came out here in 32 when they came out to make the big broadcast.
Now, you were not actually in the employ of Burns and Allen.
No,
I was working for J. Walter Thompson.
That's right. That's a funny thing. That Nat had a guy working for him. I can't think of his name. He was a great big lump of a man who also worked for Jack Benny. And this guy would lumber in to one of these writing sessions that we had and do a number of about a half an hour on what a wonderful routine he had. And then he would fumble around in his pockets and come up with the kind of a piece of paper that you make a note on when you're stuck in the desert and haven't got anything to write on. Little thing torn off a blotter or back of a matchbox. This was his routine. And then he would ad-lib some more on it. And it bugged the hell out of me because he was getting paid a lot of money to write and he was doing this number. And so I always got in a fight with him. And finally, he didn't like it anymore, and he came to Burns, and he said, either you got to get rid of Carol, or I'm quitting. And Burns says, well, you better pack up, because I'm not paying Carol.
Well, exactly, how did that work? Did the agency literally own the show?
Well, agency did not own anything. Uh-huh. What the agency did was conceive and decide what the show would be, make up the show. For uh-huh. instance, the agency decided that the show would be Burns and Allen and Guy Lombardo. When Jolson became available, we then had a very successful show, which was Rudy Valley in five acts or something like that. And I, because of my vaudeville background, I knew more about Jolson than anybody in the agency. Mm-hmm. Somebody had just sold him this wonderful singer. And just thinking of Jolson singing actually tears me apart. We had this big meeting, and they said, what do we do with Jolson? And I said, we'll do the same thing we did with Valley. We'll have five acts with Jolson. And he sings in between them and presents the acts, and that sounded reasonable to them. But I said, there's one thing. Well, this was for Kraft. They were introducing Miracle Whip. They were introducing it with a classy little offer that said, if you don't like it after you taste it, bring it back and we'll give you twice your money back. And everybody said, this is lunacy. Who's going to like it for another 50 years? you cannot like it, and who knows? So, actually, they had to refund very little. But Americans are wonderfully honest people. And I said, there's one thing that Jolson was absolutely sensational at, and that is on any show he did, about the middle of the second act, he'd throw away the book, which should have been thrown away before they produced the thing anyway, and say, come on, everybody, get together. What would you like to hear to the audience? And they'd call out numbers, and he'd sing and sing and sing as long as he felt like mm-hmm. it. And that's where You Ain't Heard Nothing Yet, Folks, came from. And it was just sensational, because when he sang, it was wonderful. And he'd do one number after another. So I said, the thing we'll do is we'll have a little time at the end of the show where he does this thing of getting the audience to call out numbers. And John said, that's John Reber said, well, fine, we'll give him 5 minutes. I said, it takes him 5 minutes to loosen his tie. And he said, well, how long do you think he needs? And I would got to have at least 15 to 20 minutes. And, oh, this was like asking for his mother's dowry. However, I think we wound up compromising on something like 18 minutes, which is nonsense. So Jolie came down and started to do this thing. And it was sensational. His power came through the microphone, and you knew that the people were standing up and yelling. And it was really very, very exciting. It was so exciting that it got down to, we lost a commercial, and it got down to where either we would have to cut him off in the middle of a chorus or do something. This was about 2 minutes before the end of the show, the airtime ended.
And it had been on for almost an hour.
This is 2 hours.
2 hours.
He had been on for about 20 minutes now with this stuff. And Reber did something that has never been done before or since. He picked up a telephone, called Merlin Aylesworth, who was then president of NBC, and bought another half hour of time.
Right on the spot.
Right on the spot.
He went right to the top.
Went to the president, bought the time, and it was an easy thing to do because what followed us were remotes from the Pistachio Ballroom high above the Mealback Hotel or whatever it was. And they didn't make any difference. They weren't commercial spots anyway, so we just bought their time. And he went on singing.
And he kept going.
He kept going.
This was a special show.
This was a two-hour show to introduce Miracle Whip, and this was the show which, with Paul Whiteman, then became the Kraft Music Hall. Not with Jolson. Jolson was just the big guest for this second show. Then we did five acts with Whiteman until we moved west and did five acts with Crosby.
Yeah. Well, back up a half a second now. You Jolson then had his own show for Shell.
I did
Shell,
that, Shell Chateau. Yeah.
Was that right after this?
No. There was some time in between.
He was out doing some movies on the coast.
Yes, he did movies. And then we did Shell Chateau for him. Hello, dear. Come in. Oh, you got some coffee. How nice.
The hospitality of the Carol household.
Oh, it's great. Yeah,
excuse me.
Hi, how are you?
And I'll get another cup. I didn't know there were two of them.
Oh, thank you.
There we go.
Don't tell me your wife's name is Carol now.
No,
it will be.
You want some sugar or anything in there?
You want something?
Oh. A little cream would be fine.
Here, help yourself.
Go ahead.
That is a cream, that's milk.
Well, whatever.
Carol, what kind of a guy was Al Jolson? Was he easy to work with?
Let me put it this way. No. Maybe this will explain it to you. When we were preparing Shell Chateau, it was my job to write the script. And I wrote it. It introduced guests, and then Al would sing a number, and then he'd introduce another guest and do a little talk with him. It was much the same routine as the Kraft Music Hall, only it was Jolson-type talk instead of Crosby. And so I wrote this script. I'd written an awful lot of this type of stuff, so I knew pretty well what I was doing. And at that time, I haven't tried it in a long time, I was pretty good at grabbing a person's style and tonal inflections and the kind of words you like. So I had no doubt but what this script would work. And he was living at the Sherry Netherlands in the room, a suite and way up in the tower of the building. And I get up there at 6 o'clock, he told me to come. So I handed him the script, and he took it and sat down at the coffee table and spread it out in front of him. And I don't think he even said hello to me. Picked up a phone and ordered him dinner for himself. He ordered a small steak and a lettuce and tomato salad and some vegetable of some kind. And then he started to read this thing, and I sat there. And the room service brought up the stuff and served it for him. Didn't say anything to me. He didn't even offer me a cup of coffee. Continued to read, and every once in a while he'd make a little note in the margin. When he was finished eating, he had just about finished the script, and he got up and went over the fake mantelpiece that had the fake fireplace in it, and he took himself a piece of what was then the classy chocolate of the time. It was Rosemary chocolates, I remember. I remember it like Rosebud. And because I was by this time so humiliated, you couldn't believe it. And I couldn't wait to see what he had written on the script. You know, 4 or 5 notations from Tyner. And finally, then he went back, put the thing all together neatly, and handed it to me and said, "Here, kid." Which was the only words, were the only words he addressed to me. And I said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Jolson, and I'll take care of it." So I got out in the hall, and when the door closed, I started to leaf through this thing to see what he'd written. And all he had written in the margin, with no indication of what it referred to, was the order, "Make better." "Make better" in the margin. It could have been anything on that page because there was no asterisk, no underlining, nothing. "Make better" on 3 or 4 pages. So the next morning, I went to my boss and Reber, the fellow who ran the whole show, and I said, "This is the result of my meeting with Jolson." He said, "What'd he say?" He said, "Here, kid." And so I said, "Here's the script," he handed me, and John looked at it, and so I said, "Make better." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, did you make better?" And I said, "Yeah, I read it this morning and it looked better." And that was the show that he did. I didn't do a didn't touch a pencil to
and
the
he
thing.
Made no comment
no
about
comment
it?
No, he went ahead and did it. And once we were sitting in the little room off the stage at Studio 8G in New York, Reber and Jolson and me, nobody else. And Jolie is reading the script that he's about to go on to do, and he starts to chuckle and he says to John, "You know, John, Jolson's writing better and better all the time." I'm sitting there. Absolute shamelessness of the man.
But he was quite a talented guy.
Oh, wonderful. As I say, just thinking of his singing raises goose flesh on my arms. I can feel a tingle. If he hadn't been such a great talent, nobody would have put up with his egotism.
Did you work for Rudy Valli in the Fleischman Show?
I occasionally saw. The show was actually written by a man named George Faulkner, who was intellectually way above anything he was doing. He was a brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally George would disappear because the whole thought of what he was doing got to be too much for him, and I would substitute for him.
Now, what kind of a guy was Valli, then?
Well, Valli was... this is hard to say. Valli was a man who couldn't sing, but sang, who has little sense of humor, but likes to tell jokes, who thinks he's a showman, but isn't, and was a big, big star. There's a wonderful joke about that. I don't really heard of it. Guy is very, very depressed. He goes to a psychiatrist because he says, I don't know what to do. I'm in show business, but I can't really sing, and I'm not a very good actor. I don't read lines well. I'm a lousy comedian. I can't dance. And the psychiatrist says, wait a minute, why don't you get out of show business? Guy says, I can't, I'm a star. This was Rudy's problem.
But what makes a star? Is it the his personality? Is it the, I mean, every old program of his that I've ever heard, he's rather stuffy on.
He is. He's very stuffy. And people thought that he gave a sort of, through George Faulkner, an intellectuality to these lousy songs he was singing. My time. Nobody ever heard any song sung through both a nose and a megaphone at the same time. This was his great. You've seen people who play 2 saxophones. This is what Rudy did. And it's some strange thing that, I guess, to a certain extent, it's the same thing that made Bing a star and Frank. But they could sing, you see. But everybody who heard Rudy said, oh, my God, I could do that. And they could. The only difference is that Bing and Frank make it sound easy, but they do it hard, you know.
You worked for Eddie Cantor after you wrote those little...
I used to to the Chase and Sanborn Hour for mm-hmm. Eddie Cantor, and he was a pretty stern man too. I mean,
I've heard that he really had to have that audience reaction right there, and he needed to do visual things to get the
oh yeah, he
audio.
Always came out in costume, opened yeah. the show, and Wallington would say, "Eddie, why are you coming out in a white sheet with a red beret on?" And he said, "I'm a candle on a wedding cake," or some stupid thing like that. Okay, every show opened with one of these silly things and a howl from the audience. Because only an idiot would do that, and he knew it. He got laughs. He was shameless as far as what he would do to get laughs. But he knew the power of sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
And we would always do some little Match Boy sketch or other where he appealed in. He was the guy who thought of the March of Dimes and started.
That's right, yeah.
And he was great. He would give away anybody's money. He was the most wonderful fundraiser. If you could get him to help you raise funds, you would make it mm-hmm. because he'd embarrass people. He'd get up and say, "I see Chuck Shaden down there in the audience. Chuck, I happen to know you made $150,000 last year. Let's hear from you for about $5,000. You know, what are you going to do? You stand up yeah. and you say, $5,000, Eddie, $10,000. Because you don't want to look bad yeah. with all these people who know you.
You're the wrong guy.
Always.
Well, my gosh, here you work with people like George Burns and Gracie Allen and Eddie Cantor and Al Jolson and Rudy Vallee.
And Joe Penner.
Joe Penner.
Oh, too. Yeah.
That's right, on the yeah. Wanna Buy a Duck.
Yeah, it was the luckiest man in the world, Joe Penner.
Why do you say that?
Well, he had this funny voice, and he was he rose to the top of radio by saying, "You wanna buy a duck? You nasty man. And don't ever say that." And each one of his two routines every Sunday was built around those three things. Different order, little different build-up to them, but people would sit on the edge of their chairs waiting for this thing to come. And when he said it, they fell apart. And finally they got tired of hearing him, and he fell apart.
But the fad was there. They really, everybody was talking about it.
Oh,
everybody
yes,
said
he was
things.
Great. He was great.
The anticipation.
He was an old burlesque comic.
Well, all of these shows were sponsored by clients that
of
were
the
in
Jay
the
Walter
J. Walter Thompson
yes,
Company.
Maybe, yeah.
How many years did you work for J. Walter?
I worked for J. Walter from 1932 in New York to 1936. And then they transferred me out to Hollywood. And I, to do the, when the show became, the, when the Kraft Music Hall became mm-hmm. the Bing Crosby Kraft Music Hall. And I worked here for Thompson till 1946. Then I was vice president in charge of West Coast for the Ward Wheelock Company. We did all the Campbell Soup stuff
mm-hmm.
from 47 to, I think it was 54. I did the Bob Crosby Club 15 show.
The Andrews Sisters and
with
Jack
the
Anderson, Carson, huh?
Yeah.
Jack Carson was on?
No, that was another show. That was the Jack Carson show with poor old the lady from the Hillbilly.
Irene Ryan. Tim and Irene, weren't they both on there?
No, not Tim. Tim had already died.
But
Tim and Irene, incidentally, were mm-hmm. the origin, the genesis, the germ of Burns and Allen.
Oh, they were?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Burns will tell you that. Is everything in show business comes from something else.
Uh-huh.
There isn't anybody, every singer that's working today or has worked for a long time has a piece of Jolson in them. Mm-hmm. And if you listen yeah. closely, you'll hear it. Everything's, there's nothing completely new. Because if it's completely new, it won't work. Nobody will understand it. You have to get your finger in something that is recognizable.
Through our whole conversation so far, the name Bing Crosby has cropped up every now and then. And, of course, you were extremely closely associated with Bing and the Kraft Music Hall and a number of other projects, too. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll get into that.
All
we're
right.
chatting with Carol Carroll. Our guest is Carol Carroll, a man who wrote for radio in the good old days of radio and perhaps most notably for Bing Crosby on the Kraft Music Hall. Carol, you are still assigned to the Kraft account by J. Walter Thompson when Bing Crosby first appeared on the music hall.
When yes, I was. I was doing the Kraft Music Hall with Paul Whiteman,
uh-huh.
and I think Lou Holtz, of fond memory. And when they moved west, I moved west with it. And I didn't know Bing. I hadn't met him in the East when he was there. And I got out to the coast, and they had already started rehearsal on the first show. I came in, and somebody, Cal Cool, who was the producer of the show, also worked for the J. Walter Thompson Company. He's not dead. Introduced me, said, Bing, this is Carol Carroll. He's going to write the show. And Bing shook hands, says, hiya, Carol, and walked back to the piano where he was doping horses. That was our entire conversation for that day.
When was this? Excuse me.
This was in winter of 1936, started in January. Mm-hmm. 1936 was when Bing started the Kraft Music Hall. And our relationship was, after about 6 months of high and stuff like that, we began to talk a little, but we never had a social relationship. I was in mm-hmm. Bing's house 3 times in my whole life. 2 of them was to go to the toilet. It's true. He had a great big party out of his house in Toluca Lake that burned down. And the party was under a tent on the tennis court, and the facilities were in the house, so I had to get in the house. That was one time. And a second time was during the war, and we didn't have any help, enough help at the office. So I said, I'm going out that way. I'll drop off the script at Bing's place, and he wasn't there, and I said, can I use your bathroom? So I got in. Oh, got in again. Oh, no, I. Since then, I've been in a third time out in Hillsborough. I went out to shoot a commercial for Thompson after I left the company. Uh-huh. They asked me to go out. But this is, we didn't really have a social relationship. It was very cordial, and Bing was getting what he wanted, and he didn't see any need to clutter his life with a lot more people like me. And we had a John Scott Trotter, who was the orchestra leader, said that the only other show he ever worked on that was as orderly and as calm and as much pleasure to do as the Kraft show was the old George Gobel television show. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, sure. Yeah.
Well, we had an absolutely business-like way of doing business. I would interview the various guests on Friday and Saturday and Sunday of the week coming up.
The music hall was broadcast, I think,
Thursday.
Right.
Uh-huh. Monday morning, I would sit down at the typewriter and write at the top, Kraft Music Hall, January 12th, 1942, whatever the date was, and write it right from top to bottom as if I were writing a short story. And then we take out each part and send it to Bogart if he happened to be a guest, or Greta Stuckold, or Reza Stevens. We always had the concert spot, mm-hmm. which nobody heard, but which we had a lot of fun with. And each guest would get his particular bit. This was done Tuesday evening. I finished and wrote it Saturday, Monday and Tuesday. This meant that everybody had this stuff to look at over Wednesday. Wednesday, I would call all the guests to see if there's anything they wanted fixed. Sometimes I would touch a nerve. Generally, they would say, I didn't know I said that to you. Well, they hadn't, but they thought they had, and that was all right. And the stuff was actually based on what their interest was. This is what made the show interesting. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of jokes applied to fit a situation, but there were never any jokes just for the sake of doing a routine of jokes. And if there were any changes necessary, and then Thursday morning, a boy from the office would pick up Bing's script and bring it to me at my home, and I would take any corrections that I had made or that had been made at somebody's request, together with anything that Bing had suggested. And generally, these were word changes, which confused me at first. It's hard to explain what I mean, except that perhaps he would put down, I would have a word like wonderful, and he'd change it to marvelous. And I didn't know why, except maybe he had some objection to the word wonderful, and he couldn't say it very well. So the next time, instead of using wonderful, I'd put marvelous, and he'd change it to wonderful. This happened many times. But people thought of Bing, and still think of Bing, as the most casual man in the world. He, too, was very organized. And these changes that I would make in the script sometimes would involve changes in his dialogue because they had to be made to fit what the guest wanted. And Bing, instead of reading the change off the paper, was reading from memory and would read the original script sometimes, which wasn't in front of him. He studied it.
Most people felt that Bing Crosby more or less ad-libbed the whole show.
Oh, this was a carefully planned plot. Uh-huh. There were no writing credits on it, and people were always astonished to see that he had a script. And for a long time, we had, quote-unquote, no audience, because Crosby said, I don't want an audience. He didn't want an audience because he didn't want to put his toque on it. And he didn't think it was polite to work in a hat. On the other hand, Bob Burns said, I can't work without an audience. I have no timing. So we went around a long time on that routine until finally we decided that we would have just some of our friends drop in. Bing would invite some people, and Bob would invite some people. And sometimes our friends made a triple line almost around NBC, waiting to get in without tickets. Nobody knew they had that many friends in the world. And because these were just some friends that dropped in, there was no applause. And occasionally, you just couldn't stop it. We had a long speech about no applause. But like when Bob Burns on the bazooka and Jose Iturbe on the piano played a duet. Da-da-da-da-da, boom-boom. Da-da-boom-boom. It got built up so big that there just had to be applause. There's no stopping it.
There was quite a crew on that Kraft Music Hall. You mentioned Bob Burns and Bing Crosby, John Scott Trotter, Ken Carpenter.
I was at a funeral yesterday with Ken and John Scott. Bing's brother Larry died. Mm-hmm. And we go to too many funerals now. Wow. Perry Botkin, who was the creator of the musical arrangements for Bob Burns's bazooka, used to say, we're getting to the age... Well, we have to keep that dark suit pressed.
There's a fellow by the name of Yuki on that series.
Oh, yeah. I got a call from the other name. His name is Leo Sharon. And he wandered in once. He became, for a while, a sort of a gopher for Bing. He'd run his errands and carry his money and things like that. He was what Barney Dean was for Bob Hope in a smaller way. And we used him for a while in our openings as sort of a stooge. Mm-hmm. But it got to be too mechanical, so we dropped it.
Bing, now you didn't have that great a contact with Bing, yet you were absolutely able to capture his style on paper and make it sound like it wasn't written.
Well, that's a question whether it was Bing's style that I captured or whether Bing captured my style.
Well,
that's
maybe
so. That's a question that even I don't know the answer to. I think that Bing had a natural affinity for language. He likes to use it, and sometimes he overuses it. And what I did was sort of channel the way he liked to think of himself as talking. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of it is rubbed off now, and there's an awful lot of stuff that's gone into the language from that show.
Yeah. How long were you with the Kraft Music Hall?
From the time it started with Paul Whiteman in New York, which was, I think, 34, through 36 to the coast, and in 1946, Bing left Kraft and Thompson and to... tape stuff for ABC. That's when he broke the tape barrier.
With the Philco Radio Time Show.
NBC would not consider allowing him to use tape. He had bought this tape. He had Bing Crosby Electronics, which eventually sold out to Minnesota Mining and Mineral. And
I thought he was part of Ampex. Or
Ampex is what I mean. Oh, excuse me. That's right. Eminem make the tape, but Bing had the patents. He got them from a couple of nice young soldiers who liberated them from Germany. And he said, I'm not going to fool around with this. I didn't have to, and he got ABC to use tape, and pretty soon you know the answer. Everybody was using tape.
It revolutionized radio.
Of course it did.
They used to do two broadcasts, you know, one for the West Coast.
Oh, do I know that?
Yeah.
On Shell Chateau, we did one for the West Coast 3 days later. We used to do Shell Chateau on Saturday evening at 9 o'clock, I think. And we did it again on Monday for the West Coast, Monday in the afternoon, so it would get out here at 9 o'clock. And I don't know whether the story about John Barrymore and that little incident is in my book or not.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, oh, that was...
Let's hear it.
Well, John was having a little incident with a woman named Elaine Barry. Between every once in a while he'd sober up and know where she was, or vice versa. And somehow or other, they sold us the idea of putting John on with Jolson to do a scene from the great play that he and Lionel did, The Jest. And John was perfectly willing. He didn't know what was happening. And Miss Barry said she would deliver him. But we finally had to locate him. He had locked himself in a room at the New Yorker Hotel in New York. And his agent and a few people got him out and brought him down to the studio. Just in time for the show, and absolutely sloshed. But he was so marvelous that when he got on, his hand trembled. You would think that it trembled so that he could not read. I know he was reading because it was not the script that he could have remembered. Mm-hmm. I also know he was reading because at one point he took off two pages and skipped two pages. And the wonderful young lady who was working with him also skipped the pages right along with him. All these radio actresses were great. But this Studio 8G had a control room in the back of the studio, so I was looking across the audience to John, to the stage. And John was up there. First place, as he came out, he tripped over a cable and said a few words that are now common gossip on every campus and high school gym, but were not really good for the air at that particular time. Fortunately, nobody believed what they heard. So And he stumbled to the mic and started this thing. I had heard up to then that a person turns green. He did. He was green. The perspiration literally poured off him. This is not an expression. This is fact. Mm-hmm. There was the floor around him had drops of water of where this sweat had fallen, and his hand trembled, and I thought he would die any minute. It got so that I couldn't watch it. I lay down on the floor of the control room and shut my eyes because I didn't want to see this great man go to his maker. And I'm not kidding. Uh-huh. And when it was over, Reber, this is the man I've been speaking of, who was he was one of the great men of radio, who always called up after a show to give his critiques. And we didn't want to answer the phone because we knew what we saw and we knew what we heard. He was snorting and grunting, trying to get his breath. John said, "That's the greatest performance I have ever heard on radio." If you didn't see it, it was wonderful, apparently.
He really carried it, but now he had to do a repeat broadcast.
Now, what do you do with this guy to keep him on ice until the following Monday afternoon? Uh-huh. Well, Herb Palese, guy I see occasionally lives out here now, was the producer of the show, and he said, why don't we take him to my house? Midgel get something to eat for him and so forth, and we got some booze up there. So we bought a case of scotch and a couple of cases of beer, and John and we took him to Palazzi's place. And I left there sometime around 3 or 4 in the morning to go home. And Midge and Herb had to go out to New Jersey to their parents' house for Sunday dinner. And he said, well, I'll give you the key. And he'll be asleep. So Sunday morning, I brought my dog, because what was I going to do? The dog rushed in, looked around, new place. John Barrymore is sleeping on the couch. The dog rushed up, took one sniff, turned around, crawled right on the table.
Heavy stuff.
Oh. This was a dog that liked gin, but didn't like that. So I putted around. This is a two-room apartment. A bedroom, a living room, a kitchen. And John Sutton wakes up finally. I don't know how long he'd been asleep, and he wanted to know where the bathroom. He couldn't find the bathroom. Well, there was no place to go. There it was. You look like. Went in there and he was awake. And as soon as he woke up enough, I handed him a glass of beer, which was his breakfast. And then he woke up a little more and I fixed him some eggs. And then he says, haven't you got anything to drink around here? This was about after three glasses, bottles of beer, cans of bottles. What he did was he'd take one of these eight our regular highball glasses, a tall highball glass, and fill it about three-quarters full of scotch and the rest, another eighth of water. And his first slug of it was to drink down half a glass, the way you'd drink a glass of Coke if you were very thirsty. And then he'd kind of nurse the other half along for a while. Well, while he was drinking like this, he was the most fascinating man in the world to talk to. He could quote on demand from anything that he'd ever done and from all of Shakespeare's works and talk beautifully about life and art and anything that might come up. Then there would come a point where he went to sleep. He'd go to sleep until it was time to wake up and start again. So I nursed him along. The Jews have an expression, sitting shiva, is what I was doing with him. It means you sit with the body. And the Palazzis came back and took over, and the next morning, the next afternoon, we took him down to the studio, and he did the show. It wasn't as good a show because he was a little soberer.
Mm-hmm.
It was a more professional show, but it didn't have that emotion, or what passed for emotion. And when it was over, he came back to Palazzi's because he said he wanted to come back and make his manners to his hostess. He's a very polite man. And we had a couple of more drinks, and then we took him down. During the whole time that we had him here in house arrest, he kept asking for a woman. And I just ignored it because I couldn't lie to him and I wasn't about to do anything about it. So finally it got time for him to go home, and Herb and I took him down to a cab. Checker came up and we told him where John wanted to go. I think it was the New Yorker Hotel. And he said to the driver, he said, my sainted grandmother always told me, when you want a woman, ask the driver of the droshky. And this bewildered cab, he didn't know what the hell he was talking about. John got in. That's the last time I saw him or spoke to him. I suppose he went off in his droshky for a woman. Checkered droshky.
John, very much. Fantastic story.
Yeah, great. Oh, yeah.
Well, after you concluded your association with the Kraft Music Hall, was that the end of your work with J. Walter Thompson?
That concluded my work with J. Walter Thompson, because there was nothing more out here that they had for me to do. They wanted me to go back to New York and become an account representative, a straight advertising man, and that was I was not about to do.
A couple of years later, Jolson came back after his movie, that's the Jolson story, on the Kraft Music Hall, but you weren't involved with
that. That was a different show. No, I'd had nothing to do with that at all. That was done from New York.
You wrote for Walter O'Keefe?
Yeah, I did a show for Nestle's Chocolate with Walter O'Keefe and a guy named Don Bester. Harriet, Ozzie and Harriet with the music on the Joe Penna show.
Oh, yeah. Now, didn't you do this, O'Keefe had a Double or Nothing? Or
That was out here for Campbell Soups.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Walter did sort of a road company with the old Double or Nothing show, which was $64 question. We had the 64 mm-hmm. cent question. It was cut down a little bit.
You wrote for Frank Sinatra, too, didn't you?
A lot.
Uh-huh.
I did Frank's first radio show, which was for, of all things, vitamins. You know, there's a guy that really looked as if he needed them. A heavy wind and away he went. And not only did I do the show for him, but I wrote a lot of his political material. He was heavily into what was then called tolerance, mm-hmm. later became integration. And also, he was a big Roosevelt man, if you believe it. In fact, he was a flaming Democrat up until one day something happened and he became a Nixonite. I never understood that yet. There had to be something there. Anyway, Frank was asked by Drew Pearson, of fond memory, if he would substitute for him once while he went on away. It was a half hour. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a half-hour Drew Pearson show for Frank Sinatra in which he thought his things. And I was on the Union Pacific San Franciscan, I think. They had a name. It was the competitor to the chief, super chief.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to hear this thing the worst way, and that's how I heard it. They had a radio in the bar car of this train. And they didn't know an awful lot about how to run a radio on a railroad train in those days, but they knew it could be done and they were working on it. And the barman had opened up the car. It was about 11 o'clock where I was that this thing went on, someplace in Utah, I think, going east. And the speaker was in the base of the bar. It's where everybody kicked his knee when he had his third drink. And I had to sit on the floor with my head almost in the speaker to understand anything. And the barman, once he got the hang of what Frank was talking about, which was the need to recognize the black people and so, he was sitting down next to me. And when it was all over, he was crying, and he said, "That Mr. Sinatra must be a fine man." And I said, "He sure is." It was really a very good... He was... The black man was touched.
Well, that's a great way to hear an accolade for your work, isn't
Wasn't
it?
Wasn't that... Yes, I was
I
touched,
would say
too.
So. Yeah, that's really, really something.
But I wasn't really out to impress the black people. I was out to impress the white people, and there was nobody there.
Did you write for Gene Autry?
Oh, sure. Melody Ranch. Mm-hmm. I named it.
Did you really?
Yeah. Oh, that's a funny thing. There was a guy named Danny Danker who was head of the Los Angeles office out here. He was essentially a salesman, and he was sent out here to service the Lux account to the extent of seeing that all the stylists had Lux soap in their dressing rooms so that they could substantiate their claims that all the stars in Hollywood use Lux toilet soap. Mm-hmm. And from this, he got into becoming quite a ruling power out here. But he knew Les Atlas in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And Les called him one day, and this was just when Gene was starting to make a noise in the country and western field. He says, "How about a show for Autry?" So Danker said to me, "Can you think of anything for Gene Autry?" So I sat down and I wrote four different possible shows, and then he wrote a letter to Les and said, "Here's four things that Carol think might work for him." I'm sitting in Dan's office while he's dictating the letter, and just as he was finishing, I said, "Wait a minute, I got another idea." And I dictated that idea, and that one that I ad-libbed was the one they bought.
The Melody Ranch.
Melody Ranch, which was Gene singing a few songs, and then we would do a little 10-minute Western movie. That's what it was. I used to go see the second show, second feature, of some show around that had a Western in it, and boil it down to 10 minutes, and that was what it was.
Well, didn't you boil down some of the screenplays for the Lux Radio Theater?
I didn't do that. No, the only thing I wrote for the Lux Radio Theater was I was part of the team that put together the framework, the thing around that the show was nestled into.
Mm-hmm.
And
Write those curtain calls?
No, I didn't. I didn't write Sonny Tubbs. No. That was real. That really happened. Sometimes they had trouble finalizing the bookings, and this CB was handed this thing at the last minute, and he was expecting somebody like Freddie March in the part, and all he could get was Sonny Tufts. So he read Madeline Carroll, so and so, and Sonny Tufts, just absolutely appalled. He couldn't believe the words on the paper. Ruined the man's career, if he had any. You know.
Did Cecil B. DeMille ever live to see Rock Hudson, huh? I wonder. Sonny
Cecil used to come on in full uniform, director's uniform, putties with mud and stuff on him.
On the stage
of the Lux Radio Theater. He liked, like Rudy, he really never did anything about the show except... read the opening thing. I did the only Lux Radio Theater show that was not a motion picture. I did a radio arrangement of I Never Left Home.
With Bob Hope. Well, you wrote that book.
I wrote the book.
Was that a ghost written thing?
Yeah. That was a funny thing that was in the contract that I was not allowed to publicize it. And about 2 days after the book came out, there's a story in some column or something with Bob saying how Carol and I put the book together. I almost sued him for breach of contract. We had a wonderful time writing. There was no tape then.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go out to his house every Wednesday evening and have dinner, and then my secretary would show up. We couldn't give her dinner. We couldn't afford that. And we'd sit there and talk just the way we're talking now. He'd talk, say something, and I'd say something, and ask him a question about something he might remember. And she took it all down, everything. And along about 10:45 or something, and I began to get wise to it after a while, Bob would say, I have to make a telephone call. And he'd disappear upstairs to make a telephone call, which lasted about a half an hour. And I sat there looking at the secretary. This was no treat. then he'd come down. I finally found out he went upstairs and took a nap. Because he has this gift of just being able to put his head down and cork off for as long as he wants, and he feels great. That's one of the things that maintains him.
That's why he's been able to do all that
touring.
He did a lot of shows for the servicemen, and during the war, I understand you participated a lot in Armed Forces Radio.
I was an OWI out here.
Office of War Information.
I didn't do any. I was not with the Armed Forces Radio. I was offered a colonelcy because I was so old. But that's right. According to how old you were, that's what they gave you. Out at Santa Ana Air Force Base, and I had a long, long soul-searching thing with myself and with the J. Walter Thompson Company, who was being depleted of a lot of their best people this way. And finally, they put it to me this way. They said, what you're going to do out at Santa Ana, besides you'll have wings on your shoulders, eagles on your shoulders, is what you can do better for the service, for all services, by remaining here and doing the public relations for whatever is necessary instead of just for the Air Force. And they talked me out of it. So instead of that, I went into OWI, and I spent night after night writing publicity that was on all kinds of radio shows and things. Stuff for Benny and Jim and Mary and Jordan and all this stuff. I don't know how much stuff I wrote.
Did you ever write the entertainment program, like Command Performance and
Command
Mail
Call? No, I wrote it, but I didn't write it. They would pick it up from the Kraft Music Hall.
Oh, I see.
They just command this. We have your last week's script. That was all they did. because there were no... the only recordings were these great big 16-inch glass uh-huh. records that NBC made so they shouldn't be sued. They would have a record of it, and they were all destroyed. The only stuff that remains of the old Kraft Music Hall is stuff that private people happened to have uh-huh. made for themselves. Mm-hmm. Myrtle McKenzie, who was the engineer on the show, when he got drafted, had all these records, and he put them in a closet at NBC at Sunset and Vine there, locked the closet, put a padlock on the closet, and a sign saying, "Private property of Myrtle McKenzie, do not disturb." And when he came back, the only thing that was left was the closet with a new lock and a lot of brooms and pails and mops in it. And he said, "What became of all my records?" They said, "We threw them away."
So that kind of sums up really the history of radio. If you think about it, those sounds from the past,
all that stuff was thrown away. You wouldn't believe.
It's really in the hands of the collectors now, who have been right. able to find it in every nook and cranny and keep it.
When I did those Chase and Sandburn memorial things, the three of them, it was unbelievable. I used to have to requisition these platters. They still have them. They keep in a warehouse out in Brooklyn, and if anybody wants them in Radio City, they have to truck them in, which means that somebody has to get them out and carry them down and put them in the truck and take them off the truck, and the truck itself has got square wheels. So every time they move them, there's a loss. You'd find half a show or the first half of the thing, and then the record is broken off so you can't play the rest of it. And all kinds of stuff like that. And I said to him at the time, I said, "You take up all this warehouse space for these monster things. You got the equipment. It isn't working all the time. When it isn't working, just tape it off and you can keep it in a closet." No, they wouldn't know how to charge it. Bookkeepers couldn't figure it out.
Well, there's a lot of stuff in closets these days.
I don't have much of it. Occasionally somebody sends me something.
Those specials that you talked about for Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy were in the mid-60s for Chase and Sanborn.
64, 5, and 6, I think they were. Or 63, 4, and 5. Yeah. I don't remember.
4, 5, and 6, I think.
Yeah.
But one was Chase and Sanborn's 100th anniversary.
Yeah, the second was the 101st, the third was the 107th. They're the only people that celebrated their 102nd anniversary.
Well, but they had tied in they did a Fred Allen thing on it once.
It was the 101st.
Yeah, and then NBC had a...
tied in on that one. Yeah. It was its 25th or 30th or 62nd or some number.
Did you always enjoy what you were doing?
I guess so. You don't enjoy what you're doing when you're doing it, because you always think you could be doing something else, or you think you could be doing it better. And I'm a guy that if a deadline is 11 o'clock, I have to be there by 9:30 with what I need. I opened up more railroad stations. I get to more theaters before the ushers than anybody in the world. But this was one of the reasons that everything went so smoothly with what I did, you should pardon the expression, because I, unlike many of my friends and co-workers, didn't show up at the last minute with something that nobody understood. And, yes, of course you enjoyed it. The thing with radio, once you got into television, was that you never knew how easy you had it, particularly actors.
Yeah. It was just easy to walk in, grab the script, and do it.
And most of these people didn't need any rehearsal. They weren't rehearsing for themselves. They were rehearsing so we know how long it took. We never did a dress rehearsal in Kraft. We used to rehearse the music in the morning, and in the afternoon the guests would come in at separate times so they didn't meet each other, and rehearse with Bing, so that the whole show, when it got together, was a brand new thing to everybody but Crosby and us. Even the orchestra didn't hear most of it. They only heard what they were involved in. So it had this spontaneity. And then we had this trick where Bing didn't want to talk. And we knew that he was a little tight with the script. So we changed some lines which would force him to ad-lib. He did, and he would. He would always rise to the occasion. Finally, we didn't have to do that anymore because he got to the point where he felt if he thought of something funny, he'd say it. He ad-libbed one of the funniest lines I ever heard in my life. I forget what it was. Oh, it was Wingy Minone. You ever hear of him?
Mm-hmm, sure.
One-armed trumpet player. He used to have a song called Mr. Capri on that Isle. And Wingy had finished one of his trumpet solos, and Bing is standing by the mic, and it's open. And he said, "Man, that is dirtier than the inside of a Russian horse doctor's valise." And I fell right off my chair. You know, that picture, it's perfect radio, which was pictures. This is a funny thing. You have to deal in pictures in radio much more than you have to deal in pictures in television. You got the pictures. But your jokes in radio have to create a mental image.
Well, you created some great pictures over the years, Carol. And I want to thank you for doing all of that. And thanks for sharing these great memories with us today.
Well, great memories to me. And we, as I say, we didn't know how easy we had it.
Thank you.
Right.